Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
Hey, Tab, really nice to have you on, man. I appreciate you making the time to come on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Don. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, of course. You know, most of us, I'm about your age. I'm 63. So anybody in their 50s or 60s, especially, you know, followed your career closely if they were soccer fans. So I know my son was very excited that we were having you on the podcast, having followed you through the World Cups. But for those that don't know, maybe some of the younger generation, you got to play in three World Cups, right?
Yep, three World Cups.
Which is pretty rare.
Yeah, actually, through the 90s, there was three of us that played all three World Cups. And besides myself, it was Marcelo Balboa and Eric Winalda. We were the three that played all three in the 90s.
Yeah, pretty rare. But those were really crucial times for the U.S. because when you started, there were no professional leagues in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it depends on where you want to start. But, you know, obviously, when we went to the 1990 World Cup, we were all amateurs, basically. Some of us made a few bucks here and there playing for either, like in my case, for the Brooklyn Italians on Sundays, or, you know, it was really the training was really up to us on our own. And every once in a while, the national team would have a camp or we would have, you know, either a qualifier or a friendly, or, you know, in my case, even in 1989, you know, the year before the World Cup, I even went to the five-a-side World Cup. So, I mean, the times were so much different that we were just trying to get as much soccer as we could, you know, regardless of where we could get it.
And fortunately, I guess for you, you were in, I guess, what was at that time. Of course, in the early days of U.S. soccer, the hotbed was St. Louis, but in your time, it was New Jersey. That what it's crazy how many players within 5 or 6 years of you came out of that area.
Yeah, New Jersey actually, you know, I was very fortunate to move to an area in New Jersey that had soccer since the 1800s. You know, the first soccer game was played in Kearney in my hometown in 1883. So, you know, it was the Scottish and Irish immigrants that came in to work in the thread mill factories. And every once in a while in a boat, they would bring a ball. And so Kearney is very tied to the history of soccer, including having a player in the 1930 World Cup. And then obviously having, you know, Tony, myself and John Harkes play both the 1990 and the 1994 World Cup together.
What, so do you think it was just looking back now, was it the immigrant coaches that you had that made a difference? Was it just the culture in that area that soccer was a major sport, as opposed to, like, you know, when I grew up in California in the 60s and 70s, it wasn't part of the culture at all. But for you guys, it was. Was that what it was? Was it the coaching? Was it the culture?
No, I mean, you know, and this is no disrespect to any coach, but, you know, most of the coaches that I had in club soccer, which, you know, obviously Tony, John, and myself only played for one club, which was the local club. It was Kearney Thistle, and we played there the whole time. But, you know, our training sessions were limited to, you know, a coach coming in with a bag of, like, three balls and, you know, and dropping them down. And the training sessions really consisted of, you know, shooting on goal, small-sided games or a large-sided game. There was nothing else to training sessions. So, but I think, you know, now that I look back at my whole career and now that I can speak from experience, having not only had a long coaching career, but also, I'm sorry, not a long playing career, but also having had a long coaching career and having had, you know, my B license course and my A license course and then my pro course, and having a pro license, I can tell you that the simpler we make things, the better. You know, there's something that a former coach I had, and I'm not sure how familiar you are with Manfred Schellschite. So Manfred Schellschite obviously is German born, but he came up here in New Jersey and coached a lot of us growing up, including later on, you know, like the Bob Bradleys and Jesse Marsh, and connected to all of that. But Coach Manfred Schellschite was very much, you know, he always said something that stuck with me and that I think is truer today than ever. And that is that the game is the best teacher. And so there's really nothing basically that you couldn't learn through playing games. And so I can see why there were so many skillful players and so many good players coming through, because all we did was play all the time. And by the way, it doesn't take away from the fact that a structured training session can be good, and you can train certain particular skills, you know, separate, and you can get better at your weak foot or, you know, little things. And obviously you need to train some tactical work and all of those things. I give credit to all those things, but
Right.
at the end of the day, it's really about you and the ball and how well you master the ball. And then it's about, I see the game in little steps. So even though I've had all the licenses, the game is really simple. It's really about you and the ball. And then after it's you and the ball, it's you, the ball, and an opponent. And no goals. How do I keep it away from you? So we have a ball, and there's only one, and it's me and you, and I don't want you to get it. I have to keep it. How do I do that? How do I develop the skills to do that? And then after that, it's me, you, the ball, and one goal behind you. So now I have to beat you to get there. And then it's me, you, the ball, your goal, and my goal. Now I have to defend my goal. So really taking the game down to the simplest level possible, because I think that teaches you everything. And then from there you go into 2v1 and 2v2 and 3v2 and 3v3. And I think within that simple framing, you can really learn everything.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, you know, they talked about early in our licenses, but even talked about all the way up into the A licenses, that the game is from the simple to the complex, from the small to the large, and mastering each step along the way is crucial. 100%.
But here's the thing, and you are saying, you know, you go from the simplest to the most complicated, and here's the issue that I see throughout. I was able to coach youth soccer outside of the national teams for about a period of about 10 years. And in those years, you know, I coached at the Jefferson Cup and the Dallas Cup and the, you know, President's Day Cup, and we played for
Right.
points, and we had to get better ranking than the other teams. And, you know, and you go into the gold level points and the platinum, you know, tournaments. I
Right.
know all of that, right? And
Right.
having said all of that, I think that unfortunately nowadays, the game has gotten so complicated. The pyramid of soccer in this country has gotten so complicated that it's very difficult for coaches. So let's say you have coaches on this show who have gone through the process of, by the way, it's a really big effort to get your C license, your B license, and your A license.
A lot of work, a lot of hours, a lot of
It's an
work.
effort. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of money. And so now these coaches are going to go back to a club, you know, after spending all this money on their coaching education. Those coaches have to get paid. And in order to get paid, you have to sort of not only teach the players, but you have to kind of put on a show of all of the things that you learn. So now I get to the complicated area of what you're talking about. Because now, what if you hired me in California? I'm not sure if you're in California now. I think you are.
Yeah.
So let's say you hired me in California, and here I am. I'm the former U.S. soccer technical director and under 20 national team coach for four World Cups, and I have my pro license, and you bring me in, and I take your players because you just hired me to coach your team because I'm this, you know, knowledgeable, incredibly knowledgeable guy. And I come in and I just do small-sided games with your players. And your parents, the parents of the guy, of the kids on your team, are going to be sitting around and going, wait, why are we paying for this? Right? But this is what happens. See, I would have enough confidence to go there and do that. But the problem is that every coach in the country has to respond to a technical director. And because of that, they have to put on this very, difficult training session that's in sequence from your activation to your small 5v2 to your small-sided possession to then the body of your work to then the tactical to then the big game, right? You got to go through the whole thing. And they have to do that. And the reason they have to do that is because their technical director is under pressure, because for the technical director to have his club in this league, the ECNL or the C, all that, you give me all the letters you want, you need to have
Right.
all of these standards. And because of those standards, now the technical director is forced to hire someone who can do all these things. Well, at the end of the day, there's all these standards and all these things going on, and who's not benefiting is the player. Because the player would benefit more from things being simple, right?
Right.
And so I think with, and of course, it's only my opinion, but I think I've gotten enough experience, forget the playing side, I've gotten enough experience on the coaching side at all levels, from youth national teams to coaching in MLS at Houston Dynamo, to say, okay, let's put the brakes on this. Our training sessions are getting too complicated. How about let's go back, let's go back to the beginning. Right? That's what matters. This is how players learn the most. And of course, every once in a while, you have to have your tactical sessions and your exercises where you have, the certain patterns to goal. And like, I get all of that. Of course, we all know all that stuff. But the simpler we make it, the more we put players in game-like situations, 1v1, the better. That's all
Yeah,
I could say about the game.
it's absolutely wild that I just posted a video, and it's crazy to watch people argue with you online. But it was just a player juggling a ball as he was walking, just left right walking down the field. And I've been to Europe, I've been to South America, I've seen 7, 8 year olds doing this, just playing with the ball. And I think that that's something, and you talked about it growing up, you guys just playing. And it's something that is the more that we structure things in the US, and of course times have changed from when we grew up to a little bit, maybe the world's a little more dangerous place and things like that. But the idea of kids just playing with the ball, Tom Beyer talks about this, soccer begins at home. And that's something that I wanted to talk to you about too, because I know you grew up, your dad had played professionally in Uruguay. So, the fact that soccer begins at home, the fact that it's just a kid and a ball and playing and having fun with it and manipulating the ball and just seeing what you can do with it. And I know it had, I'm sure it had something to, a lot to do with your success. But even in my own son, as he was growing up, it had a lot to do with his success. I mean, the fact that, he wanted to play against a ball and a wall by himself just for fun, just to see what he could do with it. And he wanted to learn to juggle just for fun, just because he wanted to see what he could do with it, I think has a lot to do with it. And I feel like, everybody wants to blame the phone or the video games or whatever, and I'm not sure what to blame is tab, but that's something missing from the creativity of the young player developing.
This is a great point you make, because you're talking about your son wanting to kick the ball against a wall. That's really where it is. That's really where it is. Himself having the desire to go and do something by himself with the ball. And that's whether, you're going against playing against the ball, against a wall, and next thing you know, now you're playing against a wall, only one bounce, and next thing you know, you're hitting it with the outside of the foot, and you're inventing and reinventing, and you're becoming more courageous to do different things, and it's you and the ball. There's a great value to that. If my dad were alive, he would hear me one more time say that, I don't give my dad a lot of credit for what I, for my soccer. My dad, of course, loved soccer, and my mom even more. We always had a soccer game on at home. Like, that's all that was ever on the TV. If I had to describe to you what my mom was like, I would say, well, my mom was in the kitchen cooking and looking over her shoulder watching a soccer game. That's what it was. That's so that's what it was. But having said that, I was also the kid who would come home and tell my dad, "Hey, Dad, I have practice on Thursday at 5 o'clock," and he'd be like, "Well, good luck, because I got to go to work." See, I had to find
Right.
my own way. So I had to get on my bike and go to practice. You know, it's not, it wasn't that overwhelming that, you know, and I know now it's different times because most of the kids that play soccer sort of come from the suburbs with parents who can drive them around everywhere. Otherwise, they can't get to places. But, you know, we lived in a city. Kearney is basically, it's a town, it's a little town, but it's more like a European little town. And so you could actually get places on your bike and get to practice. And, but that's really what it was. It wasn't really about my dad. The fact that my dad played professional for 10 minutes didn't really make a difference. You know, I mean, of course he knew the game, but a lot of people know the game, you know, that I'm just, you know, when I look at all of it and I look at the big picture, I'm just a little bit scared for coaches because they're making, you know, people, you know, and I've taken abuse over saying that I think our coaches are as educated as some of the best coaches in the world. They really are. Our coaches in this country are putting a lot of time into coaching education. And unfortunately, is, you know, they find themselves a little bit under the gun, like with having to show and having to set up all the cones and having, you know, with making, you know, it seems like smart is complicated. And it doesn't have to be.
That's a really good point. I'm really glad that you made it. Tay, when you were growing up, at what point did you ever think about what was next, or were you just trying to enjoy the game at every turn and just trying to milk as much out of it as you could, or did you have a plan?
No, I always, as long as I can remember. And this is back at 6 years old because I remember the first game I played for a real team, which was 6 years old. I always wanted to be a professional player. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I remember, and I know that a lot of your show is about college, obviously. I remember sitting in my room at NC State my freshman year in January. So we had just played the fall. And I had come in late because I was in the U20s and we played World Cup qualifying. So I missed the first few games and I was injured and I played on and off because I was hurt. And I remember sitting in my room and I had been, by the way, the high school player of the year before. So it's not like I just went to some college. Like, so I remember sitting in my room in January thinking, I was sitting on the floor next to my bed, but on the floor with my back to my bed thinking, I haven't kicked a ball in like 2.5, 3 weeks. I like this has never happened in my life. I think, where am I going? Like, what happened to me? Like, is this it? Is this like the end for me? Because I honestly thought my freshman year in college, it was my freshman year in college was the first time where I thought, I'm never gonna make it. I'm never gonna make it. I just
Huh.
don't play enough. Yep.
That's interesting. How'd you end up at NC State instead of Virginia? All of your team, everybody
Yeah.
seems like everybody from the area ended up at Virginia. How'd you end up at NC State?
Yeah, Virginia was my top choice. And NC State was my second choice at the time because there was other national team players that had gone there. Plus, there were three youth national teams from Nigeria at NC State who were really good at the time. And so we had a great roster, actually a better roster than Virginia, but I wanted to go to Virginia and but my dad, you know, NC State had an Argentinian coach, and my parents could relate to him a little bit more because we were from Uruguay. And so I remember, you know, it was the days where all the colleges used to call you at home. So, you know, your parents picked up the phone all the time. So every day you'd get all these calls. And one day he passed the phone to me, and it was George Tarantini from NC State. And George Tarantini says, "Well, congratulations, welcome on board." And I was like, I didn't really understand. It was like my dad had just committed me to NC State. So I was like, but I grew up in that environment, you know, where like your parents make your decisions. And I don't regret it once. I mean, NC State was my second choice. And then I had Indiana, Duke, and then Rutgers. That was my five that I had left for the end. So, but I was happy to go to NC State, but at the time, UVA was my number one pick.
Yeah, it was crazy. About during that time, it felt like half the U.S. national team was playing for Virginia. It wasn't that, but it felt like that way.
Right.
Every time you turn around, Miola and I think Harkes was at Virginia, and yeah,
Parks, Gelnavach, and then Claudio Rein after that. You know, it
Virginia,
was,
yeah,
So.
pretty good. How so? How Where did you find it difficult to adapt at all to college play, being that you were playing with older players and players from overseas and all of that?
No, because I had been really on U.S. national teams. Really,
Yeah.
I got on the under 20s in 1982 when I was 15. So, I had played a World Cup by a U-20 World Cup by 16. So I was already playing with older players.
Makes
And then
sense.
from then I played on the Pan American team, which was guys that were in college. And then I was the last cup for the 84 Olympic team when they brought all the pros in. So I was already playing with the pros on that 84 team. And in the end, Alkis Panagoulias pulled me aside and said, "Hey, kid, you know what? You're really young. You'll make the next Olympics. Don't worry about it. I just got Dan Canner released from Team America or something like that. And unfortunately, I'm going to have to drop you." So they dropped me. I was like, whatever, 16, 17, and they dropped me from the Olympic team. But I had already been playing for a while with older players.
Right. No,
Yeah.
that makes sense. And then you had an in you were in and then out of college. Didn't you leave college for a while and then come back?
No, well, I took a semester off when I went to the Olympics in 88,
That's right.
but that's
That's right.
all. But I was at NC State the whole time. I was there 4.5 years, and then I knew how important it was for my parents for me to graduate. So I wanted to make sure that I got a degree out of NC State, because I remember, if anything, my parents always saying, "Hey, you can kick a ball for only a little while, but your education will be with you for the rest of your life, and that's really what matters." So that was more. I got my degree more from my parents, but I did it. Yeah.
That's such great advice.
Yeah.
How did it feel to be, well, you were the first player allocated to the MLS, is that correct?
Yeah, so I was the first player signed by the league, by the whole league. So when I signed with MLS, it didn't even have team names or anything yet.
Right.
So they signed me, and the only thing I said to them, I was in the middle of a transfer from Betis in Spain to Tigres in Mexico, and the league signed me. And Sunil Gulati said, "We want to sign you because we want to make sure that when the league starts in '96, that you're back." And I was like, "Okay, well, I'll sign, but with the condition that I will only play at either the New York team or the DC team." And that's all I knew. I didn't know names or anything. And then
Right.
they started naming. And then actually, sometimes people confuse, because sometimes people say you were the first player drafted, and the first player drafted was Brian McBride when the league had the first draft, which was about a year and a half later after I signed. So, but Brian McBride was actually the first draft pick in MLS.
Yeah, I think a lot of people still don't understand this single entity model that
Right.
MLS had come up with. I mean, we really don't have clubs per se. The MLS basically owns the teams, and then there's some autonomy with the clubs, but not really. But I at the when it first came out, I thought, oh, this is really smart because I'm old enough to remember the NASL spending sprees that went on when, teams were signing Cruyff and Pele and Beckenbauer and they're bringing in all these guys and spending money, and it was just bankrupting certain teams. It was unsustainable, or they could afford to sign a player for a year or two, and then they would struggle financially, and it just wasn't enough advertising support and commercial support for the league in general. And it was obviously, in the end of the day, it was unsustainable. And I think that was MLS's biggest fear, was that it would last for 4 or 5 years and then go bankrupt. So they came up with the single entity model. And I don't know. I think at least when it came out, it was smart. What do you think about it now? Do you think it's gotten to the point where there might, I'm not sure that it'll ever happen, but ever be a shift in how the ownership works of teams and players? Or do you think this is probably it for MLS?
Well, I think to a certain extent there's already been a shift, right? Because some teams do spend a lot more than others. So they, although they're under the same salary cap, you could potentially sign a DP for whatever you want. So
Right.
you don't really have a limit. So, and we can see it, like Miami spends a lot more than the Red Bulls, for example, right? So, I think it's already there. I see the way it is now, pretty much staying. I don't see them just saying, okay, sign all the players you want for as much as you want. I just don't.
Right.
I don't think that the league makes enough money to be sustainable that way.
Yeah, that's fair. What do you think about, and one of the talks on social media is constantly about promotion and relegation and the fact that MLS doesn't have that. Do you think that that really would affect how the popularity of the game in the United States or the growth of the game?
I don't actually. I don't think promotion relegation will change the way the people feel about the game. I do feel like the league would be better if it had it, because if there's one big difference between MLS and leagues overseas, is that there just isn't enough pressure on teams. And because of that, there's not enough pressure on players. So for example, you take a team, we were just talking about Miami, but you can take LAFC or whoever. So teams just try to get a best starting 11 they can get. And then during the whole season, basically, those 11 players know that they're going to play the whole time. That's just basically what it is. Because, and if you're having a bad season, you just throw it away. So the Galaxy just went from, winning the league 2 years ago to being basically last place last year. And they saw that this year didn't start well, and then they fell far behind, and then they just basically bagged it and threw the year away. And you're like, overseas, you can't do that. Of course, you won the league last year, but you can't get relegated this year. You have to keep fighting. You have to keep adding players if your players get hurt. And so it's a little bit of a way to protecting the fans, but it does put a lot more pressure on players that currently I think MLS doesn't have.
Yeah, no, I definitely could see that. And I think that does make sense. How compare your time in the MLS to your time in Mexico and in Spain. Did you notice? I mean, I remember when the MLS first came out, and we had Clash season tickets at the time, and we went and saw games for 5, 6 years. And you could see the rawness of the league and the style of the play, and it was a little more frantic maybe than it is even now. I mean, it's gotten better. It's definitely gotten better. Younger folks may not feel that way as they compare it to what's going on in Europe, but it's gotten a lot better than what it was. But I want you to talk about your experiences with the culture and with the fans overseas as compared to having been in the United States, because you were a player here, but you were also a coach with Houston, right? So, yeah.
I think the biggest difference is what I briefly mentioned before is the week-to-week pressure to win games. You're always 2 weeks away from, either the press being all over you or the fans being all over you, or if you're a coach getting fired, or things move very fast. I mean, I remember living in Seville, Spain when I played for Betis, where we had just lost a home game, and I remember driving in the city with my wife, and I stop at a red light, and somebody was next to me, and they made me put the window down. I put the window down, and they're like, "You need to get out of here. Go back to your country. You can't play for this club." Blah, blah, blah. This happens. This is normal, and the pressure is there every day. So when you lose a home game, it's not like you can just go out to dinner, like randomly. It doesn't happen. And I'm not saying necessarily that's a good thing, but certainly keeps you on your toes. So the difference is huge. I don't think it's comparable playing in Europe and playing in MLS.
Yeah, it's just a cultural phenomenon. I remember we took a trip to Argentina, to Buenos Aires, for a couple of weeks, a soccer trip, doing some scouting and things, and it was so wild because it would literally the news would open up. Opening stories was soccer games and soccer news, and then somewhere in the middle, the president died, and then go back into the sports, and then end with soccer. It was truly part of the culture. And people have asked me for years and years, what's it going to take for the US to be a truly soccer power? And I said, it's time and culture. I mean, it's when grandparents are watching the game and your great grandfather played, which just simply takes time. and takes
Right.
generations. It doesn't happen overnight.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're likely probably a couple decades away from hopefully making, you know, because we did get to a certain point. So now, obviously, you know, we grew up at a time where we were afraid that our league would fold anytime, no matter what league you were playing in. I mean, you know that feeling. And you know, like when you travel to play at another team, and that didn't have to be MLS. That could be before that in the A League and all the other leagues. You were always thinking, wow, if you travel somewhere and they didn't have a good crowd, you're like, oh, you know, you're afraid that team is going to fold. And you feel that, like you felt bad for, like, man, soccer just is not taking off. And I think, you know, I think we're at a point now where, you know, MLS seems to be pretty stable. I'm not sure if the valuations of the clubs are really what they're saying they are, but they are stable. They have great stadiums. They have great academies. They have a great development system for the kids that is free, and that's something we never had before. And
Right.
I think that's going to have a long-term effect on the players.
I mean, you can talk about this a little bit if you'd like. I mean, what you saw happen between even how we prepped and how we were housed and how, you know, the money that was not spent on us at the 90 World Cup compared to the 94, right? And as we progressed on through. Tell our audience a little bit about how things were in Italy for you guys.
Yeah, well, you know, Italy, we were basically an amateur team going to the World Cup. I mean, what that team did, I still feel like it's amazing what that group of players did, the 1990 group, because don't forget our captain was Mike Windischmann, and Mike had already planned to retire after the World Cup because he at the time he was saying he wanted to become a mailman. So think of where we are, right? Because that was a secure job, and you know, and no disrespect to that position, that's where we were. That, you know, we went to the World Cup in 1990 to play against players that we could only watch if someone had a satellite and a home, and we could watch a game from Europe and
Right.
watch them in Serie A. And we were playing against these guys. It would be like, Dave, you and I now going to play against in the NBA. I mean, it's
Right.
we were like so far away from being like real players. And yeah, I mean, you know, then 94, you could see a little bit of a difference. I had already been playing in Spain for about 5 years. You know, John Harkes had been playing in England, and Wijnaldum had been playing in Germany, and then Dooley came in, you know, had already played at Leverkusen and at Schalke 04 and at Kaiserslautern, and then we had Roy Weggerly, who had played at QPR, and we had Ernie Stewart, who was playing in Holland. So like that team now was, it was a professional team. And then you added to that the young guys who didn't have a team, like Kobe Jones, and you know, the guys that were just coming along, Alexi, you know, those guys were just coming along. They didn't have a club, and they kind of got on the team, like, you know, so it was already, but you could already see the difference, right? So we go in 1990, where we went to the World Cup and stayed at a military academy because it
Right.
was cheaper, to then 1994. Now we're in, you know, we're in California, and we were in, you know, like really nice hotels, and now we had per diem, and we got money per game, and like there was all these things. And then you go to 1998, and 98 was completely different. Although on the field the team failed, that was truly you know, our first professional team that we had had. Because everybody was on a real team at the time. Everybody was a good player. The roster was amazing. It was a great roster. But we, you know, we got Germany, Yugoslavia, and Iran. Iran is the team, the one game we were supposed to win. The other two, we were not. We lost the two we were not supposed to win, but we also lost the game we were supposed to win. So that turned out to be a bad World Cup. Although likely, had we done well, we still would have been knocked out in the first round. But yeah, the change from 90 to 98 was huge. It was huge.
Yeah, and of course 98 was pretty amazing too.
Yeah, I mean the just the World Cup itself. I remember, you know, we it was in, you know, obviously it was in France, so we were in Paris, and that's
Right.
where our group was. And I remember, you know, like our now our bus was going, had hell, you know, a couple of helicopters following our bus, and military, and And then we get into Parc des Princes where we played our games, and you could see all the sharpshooters around the top, pointing down at the field. And, like it was just like it was immense. It was the first time really that you felt the magnitude and the importance of the event.
Yeah, absolutely wild. So you were around during the time, and I guess you were probably coaching at the time. Did you ever coach when you were in when the US youth team was in residency down in Florida or at IMG?
Yeah, the youth national teams.
Yeah. Because that's something that I often think back, and I wonder if I'm just being nostalgic, but I think about the players going in and living in residency there for, together and going to school together and playing together, and how we'd bring in players, and it's something that we don't have anymore. Have you ever looked back and thought about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a great value to that. But don't forget, Dave, that now we have professional clubs who have players all year round, and so you
Right.
can really get that locally. If you're a good player, whether you're in New York or L.A. or St. Louis or Kansas City or Miami, like your club, you can just play at your club every day, and they will provide meals for you, and you can potentially
Right.
sleep there. So you have all of the things that we did at the time in residency because no one could provide that. Players have that all over the country now.
Right, but you don't think that there's a value to identifying who the top of the top are, and then having them be together?
There could be a value to that, but you have to remember now that, clubs are investing a lot in their own facilities and in their own players. And so
Right.
they would rather have their own players than give them to somebody to train. So although it's
Yeah.
the national team, it wouldn't be the national team the way you and I thought about the national team when we were growing up. They're
Right.
thinking, wait, these are our players. We want them here because we want them. I know they're 16. We want to be able to tell when we move them up to the professional team what this weekend they might be on the bench. Next weekend they might be on our U19s. The following weekend they play in their own age group, so they can control their players a little bit better. If we had a full residency program as a national team, now you're with your age group only, and I'm not sure that the clubs would be happy with that.
No, I think that's fair. We've got more now what they have in Europe, and like I say, I think that's me being nostalgic, thinking about
And I get it.
how.
I get it. I love those times, and it was nice to see those players come through, because don't forget Landon and Beasley and those guys came from that first generation of Bradenton, and there were certainly, it was certainly a great idea at the time, and it would still be a great idea today, except for we can do better now.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. I want to hear about your project that you've got going. One of the reasons that things that want to make made me want to reach out to you was a post that you had made online about your US National Soccer School. And I know there are some programs that have been going on around the country trying to get, especially during COVID. During COVID, this became a big thing because, schools were shut down and kids couldn't train, couldn't go to school, and I was able to, hook up with John Kerr and talk about what he had going at his accelerator schools in North Carolina and trying to go around the country. But, your US National Soccer School, when did this start? What gave you the impetus, the idea for it? How does it work? And I've had a couple parents already, ask me. It's like, oh, how does this work? And I said, I don't know. You'll find out when I talk to Tab. So.
No, so the idea really started a couple of years ago because exactly what you're saying. There are more schools popping up throughout the country that do something similar like this, all with the idea of being a little bit like an IMG, right? But I think the important part for me is I kept And there was a couple of good friends of mine here, very well organized, who are connected in the soccer world, who said to me that they wanted to do this and they wanted to do it with me. And I kept saying, well, no, I'm not ready to do that. And then I started to hear about 12 to 18 months ago, I started to hear a little bit more about other sports doing it, because I was under the impression that the only type of athletes that did a school like this, where you go to school every day and you practice your sport every day, were sports like gymnastics and maybe, dance or, swimming, like sports where that train hours and hours every day. I didn't think that there was that much interest in soccer. And then when I started to see like all the other sports doing it, I said, well, this has got to be something that people will do in soccer too. And by the way, we have all these MLS clubs who can provide that for their own, 15, 20 players. But here's where this is why I'm glad I'm talking to you, because one of the things that I would like to, let's say, fight for is the fact that, just not enough American players are getting an opportunity to play. And that's not just in MLS, that's also in college. There was just that article that came out about a team in Missouri that's full foreigners now in college, right? And so the idea was, okay, so American players aren't really playing in MLS. If you look at the starting 11 of all the teams, there's very few Americans on it. And then you look at college, and I went to NC State, obviously, and NC State was, I think, mostly foreigner this year, foreign players. And you look at the rest of the rosters, and they're mostly foreign. And I know from coaching in Houston that when we went to the draft, we picked our best players, and they were like, okay, foreigner, 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 American, foreigner, foreigner, American. And we're like, well, we can't use an international spot on a college player, so we have to, what's the next American? Where is the next one that we can choose? And so adding all of those things together, I finally said to my friend John Saunders, I said, look, I think I'm ready to start this. I think we can do it. And so the first thing I said to him was, I want to be able to provide an education for students where I can sit in front of a parent and say to a parent, your child from our school academically can go to Harvard from here. And if I can say that to a parent and be telling the truth, then I want to do this school. If you find me a partner where I can sit in front of a parent and say that, because the soccer part, I'm not worried about it. I'll put together a curriculum. It's going to be great on the soccer side. I want to make sure on the academic side that we are doing what we're saying we're doing. And what we're saying we're doing is that from our school, you can go to any school in the country. If you can convince me that I can do that, then I'll do it. And so we partner up with this academy from Virginia. It's called Rise Hybrid School. And it's a great, like, it's an online system, but you're actually in class. So you're on the computer, but you're in class. So when you get up, you're actually in class with students from all over the country. And we really like the platform. And most of the students graduate early, and most of the students end up going to college with college credits already. So I was really sold on the academic platform. And then we partner up with a facility that has really everything. We have an amazing facility in Hillsborough, New Jersey, that has full-size indoor field. We have four or five outdoor fields. We have four futsal courts. We have classrooms. We have meals for the students. We have a high-performance area. Where they have trainers every day, they do their activation with the high performance group. So we can really treat players like professional players, even though they're not at a professional club. And so once we put all those things in, it took about a year to put all that together until we finally announced it in November or early December. We announced that, hey, we're moving forward with this because it's good. So the idea is to have players get a great education, but at the same time, accelerate their soccer progress by training every day. So they go to class from 8 in the morning till noon. They have lunch with us, and then from 1 to 4 o'clock, they're soccer. And some days more than other, but we feel like in this sort of arrangement, we're club neutral. We don't play games. It's all about training. So the players actually go back to their clubs on weekends to play games, but they're training with us. And this is something that the market is responding really well to.
So is it local players only that are still living at home with their parents, or do you have dormitories? Do you have players coming in from all over the country? How does that work?
So for the first couple of years, I didn't want to take on too much, so I didn't want to do residential. But we've spoken to the people at the facility there, and they're willing to do the whole thing. They're willing to make it residential. I just don't think I want to do that for the first 2, 3 years until we get a real good grasp on how we're doing it. But I'm really excited about it. I think we're going to do something really great for that secondary level of player, mostly that are not at the MLS clubs, that could have an opportunity to finally compete for a college, at the very least for a Division I college scholarship, which now is getting very difficult.
Yeah, no, it's a very, very interesting. So it is mostly local players at this point, and they're just players that can drive in, come to school, have their school day, and then go back home with their families.
Yeah, it's mostly going to be players that live within an hour of the facility, but we've already been contacted from players in Morocco who said, and we said, look, you can't come from Morocco. And they said, and they actually said, no, well, we have family that lives in New Jersey. So you're actually, there may be players from other places, and there may be players from other states coming in as well.
Yeah, that I could see that working, but just not residential at this time.
Right.
All right. So did they have meals there at lunchtime and stuff like a regular school does and all of
Right.
that?
Yes. So we're going to have better lunch than a regular school, but because we try to get them the proper nutrition, but
Right.
yeah, it's going to be like a school. You go to class and then you eat your lunch and then you're training.
So is it soccer players only, or are there other sports utilizing these facilities during the day too?
No, this is soccer only.
Wow, that's
Yep.
pretty amazing.
Yep.
Wow, that's unbelievable. So what do you want to talk about if parents want to get a hold of you about this, if they want to know more about the cost or how this works, where can they find out?
Well, they can go to our website, www.usnationalsoccerschool.com. They can go to my Twitter page at Ramos Tab. I have all the information in there, so they can click on there. And then they can reach out to us directly and we'll have the conversation. It usually begins with the conversation with the parents because the idea here is that we get the right type of player, right? Because ultimately, it's like you were talking about your son. Because what we don't, what the reason we want to meet with parents first is because we don't want this to be a parent-driven decision. This has to be the child that really wants this. Because if anything, if I'm a parent, which obviously I have 3 kids, but if I'm a parent, what would I worry about here? I would worry about that if my child, boy or girl, is not fully committed. What about the social part? How does that work? I'd be worried about that. But if my child is fully all soccer, is going to be surrounded by other kids who are exactly the same. So if anything, that's going to be a plus because now they're not going to school and talking to somebody, right next to them about soccer who's talking about the Super Bowl on Sunday. They're going to be talking
Right.
about the EPL on Saturday. That's what they're talking about. And that's the environment that we want to create. So we meet with parents first, then we meet with the parents with the child, and then they have to go through the application process of the school. If they don't get into the school, then they can't come to us. So at that point, they're off. So they have to be accepted to the school first so that academically they're eligible to come to our school and sign up.
And it is boys and girls.
Yeah, it's boys and girls. Yep.
Oh, fantastic. All right. Well, I know you'll probably have some people reaching out to you from this.
Yep.
Does this have anything to do with the project you and Tony Miola have going, building a stadium? Is that connected to this, or is that something completely different?
No, that would be completely separate. Tony and I, obviously, what I mentioned to you before about our town having a history. So soccer has been the number one sport in Kearney for about 140 years now. Kearney has never really had a professional soccer team. So it was sort of a dream of Tony and I, and we talked for years about the possibility of, hey, one day maybe we can bring a minor league team here. We want to do like a Friday Night Lights in Texas for football in Kearney. Most of the community can just walk up to the game because I think it'll have a great response. So we're working diligently with the mayor. The mayor is fully on board to trying to help make this happen because she thinks that will be great for the residents of Kearney. And yeah, we're working hard. We'd like to build a stadium and bring a minor league team, potentially, USL League One or MLS Next Pro, something like that, along that level, with no aspirations really of ever becoming like a, MLS or Division One, or we just want to have a team for the community that community can identify with.
Well, that sounds like fun, man. What a great
Yeah.
project.
Yep.
You
Yeah,
think
we're
you'll get involved in coaching, or do you guys just want to be the ownership management part of things?
No, well, yeah, I'm not looking to coach. So, we'd like to just provide this for the community. And I'm sure, both Tony and I will be involved in the ownership group. But the project is a little bit bigger too. Like we're trying to put together other ex like an experiential area connected to it. There's a hotel, there's parking, there's a lot going on there. So there's a lot that that we need to get through before this happens. I would think with a little bit of luck, we have shovel on the ground in about 3 years.
Okay, yeah, no, these projects
Yeah,
take time. Yeah,
they
definitely.
do. Yeah.
Yeah,
And
putting
we've
together the
been
financing and acquisition of the land and all of that.
right. We've been working on it solid. This month is actually 2 years we've been working on it already. And we've
That's
already
not
been
been a.
approved. We presented it to the town and we've been certified as the developers. At the last meeting on November 5th, we were certified as the as a developer. So it's gonna take time, but that's an exciting project. So that's one that I think will be fun.
What they call a passion project, obviously.
Yes, no question. It's a passion, it's a legacy project for Tony and I, and we'll get John Harkes involved as well when we get closer, because obviously John's part of the picture. Because it's the three of us, but also the mayor, because the mayor and her family have been involved in soccer for decades as well, and her kids. So I think it'll be a legacy project for everybody.
Not that you're not busy enough, but what does the future hold for Tab Ramos? Are you gonna do you have any designs on getting back into coaching or anything like that, or are you pretty happy with where your life is right now?
I don't really have any desire to go back to coaching. Not because I didn't enjoy it, because I love being a coach. I love talking to players and teaching players and knowing about them and knowing what makes them tick and all of the great rewards that being a coach gives you with the relationships you develop with players. But it was too much, Dave. It was too much, being a coach in particular in the pros. It's almost like you have to have a great roster to win always. And if you don't, all you're gaining is less hours of sleep every night, because you're up every night and things aren't working out. And people think you just go home and go to bed, and you don't. You're basically up the whole season trying to figure out what to do next. And where your players, who your players are, what they're doing, where their kids go to school, what grade they're in. Like you have to know all of these things. And it's really for those people who are listening to you on the show, who are embarking themselves on a coaching career that will lead them to the professional world. Just know that it's not fun and games. That's for sure. It's a 24/7 job. And in the time that it takes away from your family, it's just something that you can never get back. And it's really difficult. It's not for everyone. It's not a game for everyone. And I don't really want to do that anymore.
Yeah, no, I coached in college for 22 years, and I
Yep.
tell you, the reason that I wanted to coach was because I wanted to be on the field with the players,
Right.
teaching them and working with them and
Yeah.
be in the locker room with them. And the amount of percentage of time that I got to do that compared to everything else, you're right. Eventually, it's just you have to enjoy
Yeah.
all of the other bits too, but not
Yeah.
enough time on the field with the players.
Yeah. 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 And you're absolutely right. You have 2 hours with your players, and then you have the other 22 hours worried about all the other things that you have to do. And that's difficult. Not that we couldn't do it. You did it for many years. I did it with all the national teams, and then in MLS, and then in USL, and I know what it's like. And I know that, man, it would take a lot for me to go back to do that, because it's at the end of the day, life is short and we're not getting any younger.
Amen, brother. Amen.
Yep.
Let's wrap this up with the World Cup coming up. So you're gonna be doing some broadcasting, right?
Yeah, I'm going to be working for I worked the last two World Cups for Telemundo in Spanish. I did was in Russia and in 2018, and then I was in Qatar in 2022. This World Cup, Telemundo hasn't really made up their mind yet with the team they're putting together. So I signed with a company, international company, HBS TV, which does a lot of the games for FIFA. So I'm doing seven games out of Houston and one out of LA. So I'll be in Houston for about another 25 days this summer. So I'll be visiting some old friends that I left there for the few years I was there.
All right, that'll be good. All right. Let me put you on the spot. Predictions for how you think the US team will do. How far do you think we'll get?
Well, it's really interesting this time because first of all, we have great players. We hired a coach for a lot of money that's supposed to deliver, and we're going to be waiting for that. But we're in a unique situation because American teams have always been good playing the underdog role. That's what we like, and that's what we're good at. That's when we fight. And in this World Cup, unfortunately, because of the draw of the group we're in, we're not underdogs. We're the favorites, I would think, probably every game, and we have to deliver. And if we deliver in the first three games, chances are the next game we're going to be favored to win too. And I think if we can get through those first four games, get out of the group, which obviously we will, and win that second game, and then get into that game that really matters, that's going to be the one that's going to determine our success or not. That fifth game will be our success or not, because if we can get through that fifth game and get into the quarterfinals, I think the pressure will be off. And with the quality that we have on this team, if the pressure is off, watch out for the US team, because I think we can do more.
It's great to hear the positivity. A lot of your former teammates and pros have not been speaking very kindly of how the team's been and what they think is going on. So it's nice to hear the positivity from you about how you think they might do.
I mean, there's no reason, don't forget, we have Juventus's best player. We have Milan's best player. We have, on top of that, we have Tyler Adams, and we have Balogun, who's starting nine for Monaco. We have many, Dest on one side, Robinson on the other side. I mean, we have players that are competitive with pretty much any country at this point. Of course, we're not a favorite to win, but I think we're competitive enough. Let's not forget, Dave, that in the last World Cup, Argentina won it, and they won four out of the seven games they played.
Right.
They tied two, and they lost one, and they had five penalty kicks given to them, right? Which, of course, you have to earn them. But my point is, we're close enough so that if we get a little bit of luck and we get a break here and there, we can go pretty far.
Oh, I know then a lot of fans looking forward to it. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. Thanks, Tap. Thanks for coming on, man. Anything else that you wanted to? That you wanted to talk about? Any other projects you've got going on?
No, I mean, that's pretty much it. I really appreciate you having me here, and I congratulate you on this great show that you have that I know a lot of people listen to, and that is really important because you're talking about college soccer, and college soccer, I think, to me, needs to become as important as it used to be, because it still can provide good talent to the professional game. So hopefully, you and I together can help make that happen.
Yeah, well, we're going through some growing pains right now, right? I mean, all these lawsuits that have happened and the changes and these players being paid, these are growing pains. And I try to get people to understand that we've had more changes in the past 3 years than there were in the previous 50 years in how college sports were structured. So we need to let everything settle down. It will take a little bit of time, but I think in the long run, it's very important years between, 18 and 20. There's not that many 18-year-olds anywhere in the world that are playing professionally in any sport at the top of the league. It's very rare. So, a place for an 18, 19, 20-year-old to develop is very important. And I think you're right. I think college can play that role. And it'll settle down, Tab. I think it will.
I hope so.
All right. Thanks again, brother. I appreciate you coming on.